mind, good spirit. This community is great. Thank you so much for coming to the Bible study. My name is Esther Mann, and I teach at the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago, and I teach Old Testament studies there. It's called First Testament, often, to give the respect that it needs. The scriptures of our Lord Jesus Christ. So I love them and love to dig deeply into them. And I think that the Hebrew scriptures have so much to offer for our time, often treasures that have been overlooked. I've become more and more aware of how inclusive or how sensitive the Hebrew scriptures are to issues of diversity, and that the identity of the Israelites was really created in engagement, encounter with other peoples. And sometimes you have the violence of war and conflict, but oftentimes you have more nuanced kind of relationships, life-giving relationships between different families, different nations, different individuals. So I chose five passages that I think illustrate some of the potential of the Hebrew scriptures for allowing us to think about diversity in today's world, as we're having cultures, groups, coming into contact with each other in all various ways. We're experiencing a kind of migration that we haven't experienced since perhaps the fall of the Roman Empire and movements in China way back then, ever since Columbus and the coming into contact with the two worlds. The last 500 years have just been incredible, and we're just now continuing to see the fruits of that. So today, I want to reconsider with you the story of the Tower of Babel. It's called the Tower of Babel often. And I'm sure that it's a familiar story to most of us, and it's really iconic in its symbolism. This is one example. Peter Bruegel in the 16th century depicted the Tower of Babel in this fashion, as this huge, colossal building, really dwarfing the people here, but it remains incomplete somehow. Sort of a decadence. And really, from the earliest interpretations that we have, the Tower of Babel has been interpreted as a story of human pride and divine punishment. We have the earliest interpretation is in a book called Jubilees, the Book of Jubilees, which is not in the Bible, but it's from 200 BC, and it's a kind of a retelling of the biblical story. And it interprets the story of the Tower of Babel as a story of human pride and God's punishment of the people. Now, if you have that interpretation, then all of our diversity, our different languages and so forth, are a punishment, something negative, something that God has imposed upon us because of our sin. That is an ancient, ancient tradition. And if you read commentaries and so forth, you'll find that it's embedded in the interpretation. And we're going to look closely at the biblical text and see, you know, what is it in there that leads to that interpretation. But I'm also going to point out how that interpretation has shaped the translations that we have so that you're tempted to keep interpreting that way. And so I want to tell you about two newer interpretations that I know about. And recently, one is that the Tower of Babel can be interpreted as a story that mocks and casts negative evaluation on empire, Babel. Babel is the capital city of Babylon, right? The Empire of Babylon. And that, of course, was the great empire that defeated the Judeans in the 6th century before the Common Era. So if Babel or Babylon is a place of confusion and is destroyed, perhaps this is a story of God's displeasure with empires and imposition of single languages and single cultures. So this is a liberation perspective that has been expressed. that the story of the Tower of Babel is actually about punishment for the sin of empire building and of, you know, monocultures, you know, imposing English everywhere, for example, or Spanish in the case of South America. The third interpretation that I want to suggest to you today is one that Ted Hebert at McCormick Theological Seminary has proposed, and I think it's really intriguing. He doesn't see it as a story about either human sin, pride and destruction by God, divine punishment, nor of empire sin and God's punishment. He sees it as one story of God's desire for diversity, and that actually it's not in response to human sin. It's the God acts in response to the natural human tendency to want to create close kinship groups and solidarity and so forth. But God says, no, that's not the only reality. Actually, I delight in different languages of people spread throughout the world in different lands. So we'll look and see how Ted Hebert got that interpretation, which is a very different interpretation, because that would validate, support, celebrate, right, the diversity of languages and cultures that we have throughout our world. So let's get right into the text itself, and we'll read it out loud. It's short, and we'll look at its structure, we'll look at where it is, and we'll look at different features, words, phrases, and so forth, and explore those and see how we might interpret it, how we might reconsider it as a story of God's delight in diversity. So if we go to Genesis 11, Genesis 11, and it's just 9 verses. And what you'll see is you'll see Genesis 11, 1 through 9. What we'll see is we'll see 4 verses that have human activity, and then one verse where God approaches. And then you have 4 verses where you have God's activity. So why don't we get people to read a verse. You want to start by reading a verse and just go around? If you don't want to read, you can just pass. But
now the whole earth had one language and the same words.
It's a different version.
That's okay.
And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there.
Mm-hmm. And they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick and stone and
bitumen
for mortar.
Mm-hmm.
Then they said, come, let us build
not enough light in here, is there?
Build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens and its let's make a name for ourselves. Otherwise we shall be scattered among
abroad upon the face of the whole earth. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower which mortals had built.
And the Lord said, look, they are one people, and they have all one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do. Nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them.
Come, let us go down and confuse their language there, so that they will not understand one another's speech.
So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city.
Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth, and
And from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth.
Okay, very good. So now if we were going to look at the interpretation of human sin and divine punishment, what kind of words or themes would you point to? Say, aha, see, they are proud. See, they are sinning. What? How did this ancient interpretation come about, and how was it? How did it persist through so many, you know, generations?
Let us make a name for
ourselves. A name for ourselves. Okay, let me just write some of these things down. We'll come back to them. Let us make a name for ourselves. Okay, very good. So the name. Like that's kind of boasting or something.
Mm-hmm. Build ourselves a city.
Build ourselves a city. Okay. A city. Now, isn't that interesting? The city gets more emphasis than the tower, although we call it the Tower of Babel. Now, so, do you see how the city is mentioned here? Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. So, the tower is part of the fortification of the city, and it's very grand. Its top is in the heavens. Okay.
I think the ourselves part of that is even more important than the city part. As far as arrogance, we're not building God the city, we're
okay.
building ourselves.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Build ourselves. So the emphasis on ourselves. But just to get back to the city and the tower, let me just look here in verse 5. The Lord came down to see the city and the tower. The city is always mentioned first. So they're building a city. I mean, a lot of people have already built cities. Cain, for example, built a city. There was no negative evaluation of that. Okay, let me see. Now, and then in verse 8. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. The tower's not even there. The tower's not that important. Isn't that interesting? So there is the city and the tower, but the tower almost seems to be part of the city and expresses its fortified nature, it's like grand, you know, design. Yes.
But they did assume, or presume, that they could reach heaven.
Reach heaven, okay. To reach heaven. All right. So reaching heaven. So it's like a presumption. They can get up to God's
right,
level.
Right, so
uh-huh.
they were not unable, God did not let them finish the tower, which is why it says he came down.
Mm-hmm.
So they never actually really reached heaven.
So it was stopped. So it was a project that was unfinished.
He stopped it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the fact that God's intervening, coming, they're going up and God's coming down, and God says no. So just the fact that God stopped it.
Now in my translation it says reach the sky.
Reach the sky. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Shamayim can be either heaven or sky. Oh, we kind of use the word heaven. It's sort of archaic, or you know, beautiful. Isn't heaven a beautiful? And you can talk about the heavens, the different levels. Yeah, because in Hebrew, Shamayim is dual. There's like Shamayim, there's two heavens or whatever. So heavens is kind of archaic, but it really means sky. Yes.
Yeah, I think it's important to keep in mind the ancient cosmology, which would be that this tower was breaking through to the place of the gods.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Reaching heavens to the sky, breaking through. Excellent. Okay.
Is holding a thin place, and are we trying to break through here?
You know, I was going to mention that they put me in Chalet 10 on the top floor. They're like, oh, I am reaching the heavens. I can even look out there. So, yeah, you know, other places, when Jacob is fleeing and he sleeps in the place, it ends up being Bethel, right? And he says, oh, surely this is the gate of heaven, right? And there's the ladder or the sulam, whatever that is, that goes up and reaches heaven, and the angels are descending and descending. So yeah, there is the idea that there are certain places, thin places, right, where heaven and earth, the place of God and of humans and God is touching. Yeah, so you have these theophanies. And actually, this is a kind of theophany too, right? Because God comes down here in Babel. Yeah. Yes?
There seems to be kind of a fear expressed too when they say, otherwise we shall be scattered abroad upon the face of the earth.
Okay, so there's a fear. So maybe their sin's not necessarily presumption, but fear. That's an interesting one. Because that, we can work with that a little bit. As we're going forward, as we're trying to reconsider what their motivation was. Was it, you know, to take God's place, to like, you know, reach God as a matter of pride? Or, we'll look closely at the details here, but I just want to get all these excellent observations. Yes.
Mm-hmm. A couple things. One, is there significance to the Hebrew of Babel?
Right, Babel. Okay, good. Babel. So I'm writing these. You probably can't even see these, so I apologize, but I will help me remember. Okay, what to go through. So, Babel, and it is very significant. And also, to confuse, the word confuse or mix, Balel, it's related. There's a kind of a pun between Babel and Balel.
Yeah. So, uh-huh. Also, this is just the beginning, significance
this
of that.
This is just the beginning.
Amen.
Uh-huh. Okay, so it seems like, aha, just the beginning. Okay, very good.
Who is the us who comes down?
Who is us that comes down?
I mean, it's a plural there.
Right, just as in the creation narrative, right? Let us create humans. Mm-hmm. So it seems to be the... All the it's an ancient remnant, I think, of the Near Eastern pantheon, which, you know, becomes God and the angels, but it's sort of a collective. Well, in Hebrew, actually, there's no capitalization. Isn't that interesting? So that's an interpretation too, right?
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Interesting
but difficult. Yes. Other things, yes.
Well, just to back up a little bit, in terms of the interpretations,
mm-hmm.
maybe you're going to include this, but wouldn't some simply say this is an ideological legend to explain how the world had so many languages if you started with one family?
Right. Good. All right. So I'm gonna start there, unless people have something else that they want to get on the board right off. You've noticed so many excellent things and. So the ancient interpreters were smart, and if you add this kind of pattern that you do see, for example, with this flood narrative, that's the most stark example where you have human wickedness, but you know, evil in their hearts, and then God acts, right? And so in this primeval material from Genesis 1 to 11, you do have that pattern, and you can look, for example, at the story of Cain and Abel, you know, where Cain kills his brother Abel and God comes down and intervenes. Or, of course, the classic one in the Christian tradition is the fall, right, which is often interpreted as a story of human disobedience and punishment. And we can look at that, too. There's no word for sin in Genesis 3 there, and there's no terminology that really says sin or disobedience or pride in this narrative. But if you look at, you know, all those narratives that have been strung along, you can kind of say, oh, this is another example of human sin and divine punishment. And then you have a new chapter in 12 where God, the focus of God's attention is one family, one individual, Abraham and Sarah and their whole family, and God's going to start over. A new way of interacting. So, you know, you can say, oh, well, it's in this pattern, right, that continues. But, yes?
I'm curious, in some other ancient literatures or traditions preceding this one, if it was this, similar stories were going on. I mean, because I was surprised when I taught Bible as literature to high school
mm-hmm.
students that the flood narrative, that
mm-hmm.
whole flood story, that the Egyptians had. Stories that were similar to that.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly with the Ten Commandments, there were pieces of that
mm-hmm.
were also
mm-hmm.
you so it wasn't like brand new, and I was really kind of shocked, you know, because I thought it was like, oh, it was just first in the
just
Bible.
Just in the Bible,
there,
right,
yeah.
So yes, for the flood narrative, you do have especially Mesopotamian parallels. In the Gilgamesh epic, for example, there's a flood narrative. A lot of similarities, a lot of differences as well. And certainly there's creation narratives. It was proposed that perhaps Genesis 11 is a story of the origin of languages that came from Babylon. But nobody's found it. Nobody's found this particular story. I mean, because you can ask, well, why Babel, you know? But no, that's an intriguing possibility. But the literature that I've read, they haven't been able to find an exact, a strong parallel.
And does Babel translate into anything
okay.
particular?
So Babel is actually Bab Elu. Bab means gate. Elu means gods. So it's the gate of the gods. Okay. Bab Elu. The gate of the gods. So it was viewed as the place where heaven and earth meet. Right? It's the contact point. And in fact, I have to walk back here now. I like to mingle. But let me just punch a button here, and this is a, let's see if it will move now. Oh, see the Tower of Babylon in the next slide. Oh, no, that's after, before and after. This is a kind of a diorama or whatever that is in the Oriel Institute at the University of Chicago, being from Chicago, I like to go over there. And this is a picture of the great city of Babylon during the time of the Neo-Babylonian Empire. You probably, the best known king from that empire was Nebuchadnezzar. So we know the famous Nebuchadnezzar. And this is a processional gate. There's some fantastic lions on this gate. If you go to the Oriel Institute, you'll see these great lions. You come through here. But now this here is called, do people know this? It's a ziggurat. It's a ziggurat, Z-I-G-G-U-R-A-T, ziggurat. And it comes from an Akkadian word, zakru, which means to build high. Okay, wow. So maybe we're really talking about a feature. A feature that was very noticeable in Babylon, the ziggurat, let us build a tower. Although it's interesting in the story, the word for tower is migdal, which is a defensive structure. They don't use any kind of temple or sacred precincts kind of language. Now, that's interesting, isn't it? It's more neutral. The Migdal. But okay, so the ziggurat, for example, in Babylon, it was the dimensions were like 91 feet by 91 feet by 91. So it's kind of a cube, and it's actually not like the, it looks like a pyramid, doesn't it, in Egypt? But the pyramids were used, what, for burial, right, or entombment. So they were hollow structures, and these are actually human mountains. They're made of brick. Mostly mud brick. Now that's fascinating. People knew something about these structures. It says, come, let us make bricks, burn them thoroughly. They had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. So that's fascinating because from an Israelite perspective, you'd use stones, of course, and you'd use stones and mortar. That's how you'd build. But in the Mesopotamian region, you have mud mostly. So they knew, they built the bricks, and apparently from archaeological digs, and there are about 28 of these structures in the Middle East. If you had a big city, you'd have one of these, like a water tower today or something. I don't know, what would it be, this courthouse probably, I don't know. But they were solid all the way through. So they were human-built mountains. They were human-made mountains. And at the very top, in this one, in lapis lazuli, in blue, as the blue of the heavens, you have the a temple, but it wasn't primarily used for rituals, it was just viewed as the dwelling place of the gods. So it was a kind of a point of contact, you know, that thin space. So fascinating glimpse, I think, in this story, perhaps, of something that the exiles would have seen or travelers would have known. Yes.
The land of Shinar or something. Does it have any significance?
Oh, yes. Okay. So the land of Shinar is actually the plain in which Babylon is located. So fascinating that you have this location. Now, those who are interpreting the story as a polemic against empire, like Babylon's a bad place because they conquered so many people, they homogenized so many nations, therefore, you know, God destroyed or caused it to cease. They would say that Babylon is a place of confusion, that the story makes fun, it mocks the power of Babylon. But Ted Hebert says, actually, this isn't etiology, it's a story of the origins of cultures, and Babylon is the cradle of civilization. So he thinks you don't have to see Babylon as a bad place in this story necessarily. It's just a story, you know, as we say, well, where did civilization start? Well, probably in Africa, you know, along the Indus River. You know, there's these various places. So in this worldview, in this story, Babylon is the cradle of civilization. That's a possible interpretation.
Then how does he get past verbs like confuse and confound,
okay,
which have negative connotations?
Excellent. He'd say that those are interpretations, translations that are influenced by the history of interpretation. And I'll go through some of those, and they're really fascinating. Okay, good. So asked a lot of great questions. And noticed a lot of really fascinating things. These are really the essential, what you've mentioned are the essential things that people have noticed. And so now we're going to go back and say, okay, let's look at this as a story, an etiology, right? A story of origins, of cultures. And notice where it's placed in the larger story of Genesis. It's after the flood, right? And you have these three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and they symbolize the three distinct families that would become the diversity of the known world at that time, right? Japheth was going to be kind of the northern, the Greek, Turkey, Greece, everything up there, and Shem is going to be the Mesopotamian region, and also Shem is the Israelites' understanding of themselves, and Ham is anything having to do with the with Egypt. That was the world as they knew it. So the flood story really, it stresses the unity of all people, and that they had one ancestor, Noah, and his wife, but also the diversity. And in chapter 10, if you notice, there's a list, the descendants of Noah's sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Children were born to them after the flood. And they go through verse 2, the descendants of Japheth, including Yavan, which is Greece. And then in 6, the descendants of Ham. So that has to do with Egypt. And that's longer. Look, from 6, it goes all the way down to 20. You know, the Israelites had a lot of interaction with the Egyptians, and actually Egypt controlled the land of Canaan during the period of the Exodus. Which is amazing to me. It's like, wow, what's the meaning of the Exodus when you realize that Egypt was controlling also the land where the Israelites were fleeing, according to this. But anyway, that's a different story. So Ham, and then Shem in 21. And notice that all of these children, they're all sons, they're actually different cities, different regions. Look, the descendants of Shem, into Elam, Ashur, that's a city name, Aram, and so forth. So you have city and region names. And it following each of these descriptions, you have this, you can see it in 10:31. These are the descendants of Shem by their families, their languages, their lands, and their nations. So there was, according to this version of the story, after the flood, the three brothers sort of set off, and there was diversity, right? Families, you had kinship groups, you had languages already. They just started speaking different languages. They dwelt in different places, and they had larger political units, nations. So this is one version of how diversity amongst people came about. Is after the flood. And it's actually according to God's plan. Look at chapter 9. After the flood, God blesses Noah and his sons, and he said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply." We've heard that before in Genesis 1, right? "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth." So they're told to fill the earth. And in chapter 10, they do it. They just go out, and the world is as it should be, united by a common ancestry after the flood and yet diverse. Yeah?
Good question. Are any of these named here actual descendants of Nimrod? So that Nimrod has a negative connotation.
Okay.
He was the real kind of leader here, the whole Babel thing.
Good, okay. So let's look. Nimrod gets more press than anybody else. If you look at chapter 10, under chapter 10, the descendants of Ham, Cush, which is Ethiopia, Egypt, we know Egypt, Put, and Canaan.
Verse 9.
And the descendants of Cush, okay, and so forth. Cush, now this is Ethiopia, right, became the father of Nimrod, and he was the first on the earth to become a mighty warrior. He was a mightier hunter before the Lord, therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. And then it goes, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. Now, so what's so odd to me is that he's associated with Ham in Egypt and then Babel. Erech and Akkad, all of them in the land of Shinar. Now, what's so negative, though, about him? He's developed in the Midrash as a kind of overlord, like an evil overlord who started Babylon. It's like instigator, so he's like the real proud guy. So thanks for picking that up. That's in Jewish interpretation, Midrash, and so forth. Are you familiar with that?
A little bit.
That's great. Do you want to add anything?
No, I'll let you continue.
No, but that's really fascinating. So if I just read this without sort of the history of you know, the rabbinic, there is a negative interpretation of him as arrogant, as, you know, overweening, and so forth. It's not really a bad description. It was just like, okay, here's one of the heroes, right? Father of Nimrod, the first one to become a mighty warrior. He's a warrior, so he's aggressive. A hunter. And so everybody who is a good hunter, I guess they would say, hey, you're like Nimrod. Mm-hmm. We have like that. But there's nothing like that. That's negative. Do you see it?
Well, he builds Nineveh.
He built Nineveh. He's an empire builder.
He goes into Assyria and built Nineveh.
All of those other.
And.
Mm-hmm. So he's a big city builder. And the cities become the enemies, yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So maybe the Nineveh reference.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that you mentioned, I'm going to go back to this Peter Bruegel thing.
Do you want us to go back one?
Just one back. Okay, good. Okay, thanks. The guy on the corner there, here, is often seen to be Nimrod. Yeah. And see, they're all bowing down to him and so forth, so. Uh-huh. So this is part of the tradition that he was like an evil king, right? And that he
was kind of not questioning, but wanting to be like God, or
be like God,
reach
the heavens,
be like them. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So isn't this fascinating? It kind of builds. I mean, this is in the 16th century by a Christian artist. So it kind of builds that there was this proud, you know, overextending king. Yes?
Isn't this a contradiction in terms of when we have verse 1 out of chapter 11, when it says they were all the same language, and here it tells about the sons of Noah, all different languages.
Very good. Excellent. So what would you say then when you see that?
I think this should be before.
It should be before. Yeah.
Who wrote this?
Let's rewrite it. I got a pair of scissors.
But I mean, it seems like when you talk about that, it's a kind of description.
Right, it seems out of order. It's like, wait a minute, we're back. The earth had one language and a few words. It says one language and the same words, but it's actually Devarim Achadim. It's like just a small set of words. Yeah, so we're here back before there were the diversity, right? And so clearly, one explanation would be that this is a different tradition. But it was a well-known tradition. It's like, okay, now we're talking about the origin of legend. Hey, do you remember that one? Oh, yeah, that everyone knows that one. We have to include that one. So there's one story that says, well, you know, after the flood, the three sons, they just spread out and things just
naturally
happen.
Where'd they get their wives, you know?
Wow.
Exactly. Well, they came on the ark. There were eight of them, right? Well,
do we know anything about the authors of these passages?
Okay, well, so this, in Genesis, the classical source critical method would say that the Tower of Babel story in 11 would be the J source, and that used to be dated really early, like in the 10th, 9th, 8th century before the Common Era, and that chapter 10, with its emphasis on genealogies and so forth, would be the priestly source. So from a different group, a different focus, you know, they were interested in kind of who's who and so forth, whereas the J source, it's called the J source because they use the name, which is indicated as Lord here, L-O-R-D, capital, kind of small caps, which stands for the personal name of God, which wasn't pronounced after a time, which was probably Yahweh. And J, the Germans gave it the name, and so you spelled Yahweh with a J, so they gave it the J source. And so things associated with the J source in this early material are, for example, the creation narrative of Adam and Eve in Genesis 2-3, and also some parts of the flood narrative, and this one. So it seems it could be a different source. Now, people have been wondering, well, is this really, you know, they're really just the four sources, or are these different traditions that are gathered together? But clearly, it's a different tradition. And it's kind of backing up. It's like, oh, okay, here's a different version of that story of origins. The whole earth had one language and the same words, and they migrated from the east. They became came to a plain. Okay, so it's a story about sort of how culture originated in the east. That's interesting. All right. So I would say it's a little different. Version, and let's look at some of the other things that you pointed out, because I know time is going so quickly. We have the plain of Shinar, which is where Babylon is located. They said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. Okay, they had bricks for stone and bitumen for mortar, so we know something about their construction. They would build their cities like that too, not just the ziggurats.
It's interesting. My version says asphalt.
Asphalt. Oh, okay. That's a nice. It makes it a little more known. What is bitumen?
Yeah.
Okay. So they're saying. What do you have?
Slime.
Okay. Interesting. So here we have a number of different interpretations of how they were constructing these things, huh? So they are urging one another on. This come, let us make, it's just a way in Hebrew of proposing an action. So it may sound, you know, we're wondering, is this presumptive that, you know, they're organizing? Well, it's like having a, I don't know, long-range planning committee.
There it is again, it's a committee.
There's the kid. That's the sin, right? There you go. All right. Well, consider that. That's good. So let's see. Come, let us build ourselves a city. Not ourselves. No, is that really so bad? Let's build. I mean, Holden says, come on, let's plan our future. Is that bad? Our future? I mean, it's just. Is it? Because it has to be God's future, or possibly. Okay, well, let's build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves. Okay, so they want to build a city that's fortified with its top in the heavens. Now, the top in the heavens seems to correspond maybe with this understanding of the thin places, but it also is just a very common way of talking about a very tall building or structure. So it's not necessarily, you know, to say, oh, this is their sin, they wanted to build high. And I'm being from Chicago with the Willis Tower, the former Sears Tower. Ooh, that was a big sin. But if you look at
World Trade Center.
Oh, that's, I was going to mention that, but that lens is kind of tragic. Element there. Deuteronomy, if you look at Deuteronomy 1, remember the spies are going in to spy out the land, and in Deuteronomy 1:28, it's interpreted, the Lord hates us. He's brought us out of the land of Egypt to hand us over to the Amorites in the land of Canaan. Where are we headed? 28, it says, Deuteronomy 1:28 says, our kindred have made our hearts melt by reporting the people are stronger and taller than we are. The cities are large and fortified up to heaven. So it's not necessarily a sin, but it's like, oh, they're so tall. Yes.
Is there any way to distinguish, I think, uh-huh. some of the Psalms between a reaching after God in a kind of this arrogant way and a yearning and a longing for God? You know, my heart yearns for
uh-huh.
courts of the Lord.
Yeah.
Is there possibly any of that sense
uh-huh.
in here where that
uh-huh.
it's a yearning and a longing for God rather than a reaching
right.
and a grasping
mm-hmm.
and a Mm-hmm. elevation
that's,
of self.
That's really something important to keep in mind. Just for now, it's a really good question. I think it's good to long and reach for. But notice that God's not even mentioned in this, top in the heavens. You know, it's just like, wow, really tall one, and let's make a name for ourselves. Now, is that bad? Yes. Okay. Someone say yes. You know what? God makes a name for Abram in chapter 12. I will bless you and make your name great. Now we can say, well, God's doing that, not the humans. Maybe it's bad for humans to do it. But if you look at Ruth, we're going to look at Ruth later this week. I'm just pointing to a few ones. At the end, the elders bless Boaz as he's taking Ruth as wife and so forth, and saying, have many descendants by this woman, by Ruth the Moabite, and make a name in the city. So they're encouraging him to make a name. What does that mean? It means to establish a solid identity that persists beyond the one generation. So they want to establish an identity. Come on, let's have a city, let's be fortified, let's have a single identity, a strong identity. Well, we're always kind of going between having a strong identity and reaching out to others, aren't we? But here, they want to do something that's worthy. Now, but why? Yeah, this gets back to your excellent question about, were they seeking after God? Were they prideful? Did they want to usurp God, take God's place? Look, it says here, otherwise, mine says otherwise, I want to hear other translation. Otherwise, we will be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. That's their reason. They don't want to be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. Somehow there's a fear. So they don't say, so that we can reach God, or so that we can seek God, or that so that we can become the most important. Or they're not saying any of that, because otherwise we'll be scattered. They don't want to be scattered. They want to be unified. They want to be one culture, we would say. So that's the otherwise. Now, what do other people say? Less? What less?
Is the tower going to be then represent them and be a symbol of
maybe
their
it would be a symbol.
People? Mm-hmm.
Maybe so. Maybe it would be a symbol. Maybe it would be it's like, who are the enemies if they're all there? But it could be for defense. It could be like the walls on our borders. Defining who we are. Right, on the Mexican border, for example. So it could be for defense, it could be for identity, it could be for borders, boundaries. Although, you know, it says that they're one people. Yes, uh-huh.
And I don't know anything about the geography there, except you did use the word plain, it was on the plain. And I know driving across North Dakota is a good example.
Featureless.
Across, and, you know, when you get your first glimpse of the city that is not something like that, you know, it's like, but there are times when you're looking for that first glimpse of the destination. I don't know if people could be lost out there in the desert.
Lost out there.
I think I see it.
Yes,
it,
okay,
yeah,
good.
Let's go that direction.
So you're looking for the water tower or whatever. I was
yeah,
like, count
yeah.
the water towers. Yeah, and I got a ticket, actually, on the open road. I could, you know, I was very contrite, but I said, officer, I'm not used to the open highway. Ticket anyway. You know, it's tempting to just go, you know, where you, you know, there's no landmarks, you know, how are you going to get your bearings? Yes. Mm-hmm.
It used to be too, as you came to these towns, they had their churches, had big spires.
The spires, yes, and that was the identity of the people,
right?
That's really what they valued, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe, you know, with this sort of anti-colonial bent, you could say, well, you know, they were fortifying, so maybe, you know, their military or whatever was their preeminent thing, yeah.
You could say that they enjoyed being in community.
They enjoyed, that would be a positive.
Their family members, their friends, they don't want to be refugees.
Right, they don't want to just be all over.
Across the face of the earth.
Right.
So
exactly. So that's that would be a possible positive understanding that this would be a natural longing to be in community together, right? To support each other in all their needs, right? Whether that be like economic, whether it military protection, whether that be the religious, you know.
And maybe they also already knew that it's really hard to be a refugee.
It's hard to be a refugee, and so much of the Bible is about being a refugee.
Exactly.
Being out there, yes.
Except in the context, isn't the reason that they want one language and a unified people is so that they can build the city and the tower to storm the heavens and make their own name in contrast to honoring the name of God? I mean, in the context of Genesis 1-11, and in this context, I think it just seems like really stretching to see a positive sense when the purpose of the unity is to storm the heavens.
Well, see, that's you're in a very good company. You're of generations, so
yeah.
You're generations. But I just want to look here. It says otherwise or lest, or I don't know. You might have, but that would be that would indicate the pen. That's the preposition that there. Lest we be scattered abroad. So that, in other words, it doesn't say so that we can become like God. With our eyes open or whatever, and, you know, but we don't want to be scattered. So just to go on here, just because we have only 10 minutes, let's look at some of the other things that people mentioned here. The Lord came down to see the city. Now, this is interesting. You know, this is this sort of two-tiered universe, cosmology, right, that people are here, God's here, so people are going up, God's coming down. Very anthropomorphic view. This is another thing about the J source, as God being, you know, not omniscient at all, but kind of like, wait a minute. Has to come down and look. They look. They are one people. They have one language. Now, this is only the beginning of what they will do. That is an interpretive translation. You could translate this, they've begun to do this. Like not saying, now they're going to do all this other stuff. It's just like, look what they're doing. Kind of God's surprise. So there's a recognition. So God's sort of responding to what the people are. It's not like God's in this J view, God sort of explores what humanity is and responds always. And so you could say, look, there's just one people, they're one language. This is what they're starting to do. This is what they're doing. Now, you know, they're unified. Okay, so I think that this is good ammo for those who want to build on it, but let's look at 7. Come, let us go down and confuse their language there so that they will not understand one another's speech. The confuse, the Balel, I told you that Babel and Balel, Babylon and Balel, they're very similar, so it's kind of a pun. The Hebrew scriptures love those kind of puns. They're sort of fake etymologies, because Balel really didn't have anything to do with Babel, because we said Bab-Elu, right, is the gate of the god. Balel means to mix, And in other contexts, for example, Leviticus, it's when fine flour is mixed with oil and so forth. So it doesn't have a negative connotation anywhere else except this interpretive translation. So you could just say, let's mix their languages.
That doesn't have a negative connotation at all.
Yeah, no, let's just mix it. Stir them up. Let's stir them up. So you see how the history of interpretation, ever since from 200 BC to now, has like shaped the translation choices, which makes us continue to see this as a story of human pride and divine punishment. So mix, so they won't understand. Now, is that good or bad? The Lord scattered them abroad, exactly what they feared. Right? So they're not able to stay in community. It's exactly what they feared. So I suppose that it would be experienced by them as some kind of punishment or disappointment or something. And left off the building. It says, it's called Babel because the Lord there confused or mixed their language of all the earth. And the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of all the earth. Now that was what, in Genesis 1, right? That was the commission to the first the human beings, right? That they were to, God blessed them in Genesis 1:28. God blessed them and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it and so forth. So they were commissioned, they were blessed to fill the earth. And here he's scattered, and it may be perceived by those people being scattered, their fear of being scattered, as something negative. But actually, it's in keeping with that first blessing of the human couple that they should fill, that they should go out, that they should be different peoples and so forth. So I'd like to propose at least that we reconsider the Tower of Babel not as a story of the arrogant pride of Nimrod, who never really is in the story at all, right? But an ancient etiology of people's longing for community, to be similar to one another, but God saying, no, actually, larger blessing is in being in diverse communities with our distinct languages, cultures, regional traits, and so forth.
That's kind of consistent with the sermon last night, that we aren't supposed to judge.
That we aren't supposed to judge, yeah.
Well, their desire to become community, to be as one, there's a component of fear in there, a big component of fear and of, you know, not wanting to reach out.
Putting up walls.
Yeah.
They've seen the mob outside the gate.
Of course, if everybody was inside the walls anyway, you wonder who they were going to reach out to. But right. Tis a mystery.
So there's kind of this, what is it? Centrifugal and centripetal, which is which, scientists. But anyway, this desire to come closer, be unified, be one, understand each other, be like each other, right? But also the divine imperative to respect, to become, to grow in our own, in our differences as well. I see one hand in there. Uh-huh. Yeah.
As you look at the fear of the Jews of the disaster in the last words of the Seder, next year in Jerusalem.
Jerusalem, uh-huh.
I mean, this is an overwhelming
desire. A desire to unite, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, although the reality has been that the Jewish people have been a diaspora community and have been able to preserve their identity.
They have always
identity.
Had that,
the
Seder, mm-hmm. next year in
next
Jerusalem.
Next year in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when Israel was falling, mm-hmm. it's this year.
Mm-hmm. So, it would be interesting to think about how this story would resonate in diaspora as well, as another story of diaspora at the origins. Yes. Uh-huh.
How does the building of a Tower of Babel differ from our building of churches?
Of churches?
I mean, don't we have steeples that go as high as...
Mm-hmm. That's a very good question. Mm-hmm. So it would be a desire, I think, in most of our building of beautiful churches and so forth, a desire to actually give glory to God, right? I see one back here. Somebody hasn't spoken, so let's...
Well, I was wondering about the connection, the natural connection between gathering and sending in our ritual.
Wow. Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you. Thank you for that contribution. So that sort of expresses both of those, the human desire to be unified, and then also God sending us forth across the face of the earth.
Yeah. It's interesting that the contemporary Israelites, or the contemporary state of Israel, is one of the most restrictive, and it has a litmus test for citizenship for ethnicity, language, religion. You know, it's an ingathering.
Well, there's a bit of the aspect of, I'd say that Israelis are one of the most diverse populations that I've ever run across. You have Ethiopian Jews. You also, 20% are the Arab Muslims. They have a similar history of discrimination, so forth, that I'd say, the African diaspora here, and also have in our country. But there's three official languages, Hebrew, Arabic, and English. And although it keeps getting tested by those that are pushing Hebrew only, that's not, about 60% or so of the Jews there are not religious and don't push it. So it's complicated. So I wouldn't want to take Israel as like the prime example of that kind of exclusiveness, because I think I see it in our own culture too.
But is Judaism a litmus test for citizenship, religious?
No. It is for the right of return.
Right.
Yeah. So, but about 20% are non-Jews.
Yeah.
But now, let me just show you that you have such good observations. I had a few other slides, but I want to just leave you with a couple of interesting pictures. I don't know if it's good. I like your gathering and sending as a good closure so far. Wise, I would have stopped there, but I'm not. So here is actually a ziggurat. This is Ur. And this was built, this is the Ur of the Chaldeans, where Abraham started off. And this was built like 2,000 years BC. So it's like a 4,000-year-old ziggurat made of mud. And rusted, and others, they're exploring in the early 20th century. Now look at that.
Wow.
That was reconstructed. Who did that?
Disney.
Who made a name for this?
Disney.
Disney. Saddam Hussein in the 80s.
Oh.
He was seeking some kind of symbolism for Iraq that would go back behind the Muslim divisions, the Shiite, the Sunni, the regional. So this is a unifying, he put faces on the old ziggurats. You can see that the old ziggurat's still there, right behind it.
The
old ziggurat is
the symbolism. Isn't that interesting? And here we are. So may you go out and perhaps not storm the ancient symbolism, but isn't this iconic? The story of Babel continues to be so iconic. There's a film called Babel. I haven't seen it. I don't know who's seen it, but it's just such a powerful and I would say a complex story, even though it's so short. I don't think you can. It's not easy to reduce it to one of those meanings, is it? And I think that that's what helps preserve its vitality as we move into different contexts and so forth. So, thank you for gathering today, and blessings on your dispersion.
Yeah.